This podcast is not intended as a substitute for professional help. If you or someone you know is facing difficulties, I advise you consult a psychologist. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Psych for Life with Dr. Amanda Ferguson. I'm your host, Dr. Amanda Ferguson. Today's episode is about family and general dispute resolution, finding strengths and growth with Rosemary Gattuso. Rosemary Gattuso is a dispute resolution practitioner and counsellor specialising in family dispute resolution and restorative justice with trauma-informed approach. Rosemary's career began as a lawyer and then progressed away from the courts and towards mediation rooms. She became curious about how people manage personal crisis, adversity, and self-reflection. And after completing postgraduate studies in dispute resolution and then mediation at Harvard University, Rosemary became a mediator for the Family Court of Australia. This placed her in a unique position to observe and learn. She then became a couples and family therapist with further self-study of childhood trauma and emerging discoveries about the brain and the mind. Welcome, Rosemary. How wonderfully diverse and rich your background is.
Thank you, Amanda. It's lovely to be here.
Oh, it's so exciting because we connected a while ago, and because our fields of work overlap, and I sometimes have to refer to experts like you who specialise in dispute resolution. And what led you to move away from the law to this therapy side instead?
Well, it's quite an interesting story because I guess the whole time while I was studying law and getting ready to practice law, I knew it wasn't for me. Uh-huh. But I thought, well, I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to finish what I started. And then I had a compulsory mediation component in the very last sort of, 6 months of the practical training during the placement.
Yep.
And everyone sort of hated it or was just like, oh, what a waste of time.
Yeah.
And to me, it was the first time that I felt, wow, I could really do this. This really supported my strengths as well, whereas I felt that in the legal setting, it really highlighted my weaknesses,
So your lack of interest, really.
Yeah. And so from that point, I began pursuing alternative dispute resolution, which is essentially anything outside of court, which is more the traditional method of dispute resolution. But I always had an interest in family. So I was always looking at working with families and children from a legal perspective. Mm. And so it was only natural to then flow on into family mediation.
Absolutely. So you must have seen many problems that led you to this alternate dispute resolution over your 15 plus years with this specialization in family mediation and restorative justice practices. What is really alternate dispute resolution other than being out of the courts? Is it still the same or is it quite different? What's the difference?
Well, I guess this is the way that I often explain it, because it doesn't always come natural, or a lot of people haven't had experience with alternative dispute resolution or mediation. They're just used to traditional legal system, and the legal system is evidence-based. So mm. I'm bringing forward my case to prove why I'm right.
Yes.
And why you're wrong.
Yep.
Whereas a mediation process is not necessarily, well, the way that I work, and especially, working with families, it isn't strictly evidence-based. So people can bring forward their evidence, but it's really about reaching an agreement.
Mm.
So it doesn't have to rely on what could happen in court or who did what, when, and how in the past. It's more future focus on how can we work together. And particularly from a family perspective, where you have two parents who have to work together for the rest of their child's life, or at least while they're caring for their child. So it's in their best interest to be able to have mutual respect for each other, or at least to be able to be civil.
Oh, it sounds really family focused and really positive.
I think so, because you get a very different outcome, because it provides space for conversations that wouldn't ordinarily be had in a courtroom, because there's a completely different focus.
Yeah, and
So there's also, so like you'll have couples who maybe have separated and haven't had a conversation for longer than 10 or 15 minutes come together into a mediation room, whether or not it's face to face or virtual or even in separate rooms. And often it's the first time that they've been able to talk. And that can be quite a challenge, but it can also be a bit of an icebreaker and help sort of smooth along. And you could have a mediation that goes for 3 hours, and maybe in the last 30 minutes, there's a bit of a shift, and it goes from, say, 2.5 hours of back and forth and blame and this and that to, okay, this is our future now. How can we work together? And more understanding and maybe more even compassion, I would say it. Maybe my clients won't describe it as compassion, but I think that's what I see.
Yes. Well, just from the start, you're not in a courthouse, so your defense mechanisms are probably lower than they would be. You're in a more natural setting, I presume. So you've mentioned mediation rooms. Are these just designated meeting rooms that you use? And
Yeah,
therefore people, they wouldn't be
that's
as
right.
on.
And some of them, physically look like or similar to counselling rooms with a table. Some have coffee tables, so it can be, or it could be from home if it's virtual. So and then I'm not a judge, so I'm not there to take sides or give a judgment. No one has to prove anything to me. My role is neutral, except to the extent of pushing the children's best interest forward, really, or focusing on that. Because often when you're in conflict, even though, yes, you do have your child's best interests at heart, there's, I guess, a conflict of interest in between, being hurt and grieving and anger around the separation that happened between the couple, that can often delay a bit of the process and take away slightly from the focus of the children, because it's like, well, this happened in the past, so I'm not going to agree to this, or I'm worried about this because of the past.
So is the focus really on moving the family forward or the child forward?
Well, both, because they're all together. Whatever happens, if impacts all of them. And I describe it as an upside down triangle. Well, I say a triangle kind of like that. Well, yeah, a triangle with the point facing down. So you've got the horizontal line at the top where mum and dad are on each corner, or parents, whichever, the parents or caregivers are on each corner. And then the angle of the triangle that's facing down is the child. So if all sides of the triangle are impacted when there's a change or a move or something happens on either side, if that makes sense. If you look at construction, all three sides will impact the other. So I guess that's how I describe it and often illustrate it for clients who say, well, I don't speak bad in front, or I don't do this or don't do that. But then there's subtle sort of behavior and actions and approaches that imply, disdain and hate and distrust for the other parent, which can really be emotionally harming for the child. And particularly now, where I find there's a rise of the sensitive child, seems to be more and more children who are sensitive. And I'm kind of undecided as to whether or not part of that is a child adapting to their environment and becoming sensitive because of what they've been exposed to, or a child who's biologically more sensitive. I think I see the two, and it doesn't matter which one this child falls into. The focus is on how can both parents work together to meet the needs of that sensitive child.
Oh, that's such a good point as well. So, first of all, that triangle that you mentioned shows us and reminds us that the three are so interrelated, the parents and the child, that there's a ripple effect, that even a slight tone has that effect on, and that triangle, that interaction and interrelatedness of the child with its parents, no matter what is going on for each of those parents and between them, or between one of them and the child. And that's such an important reminder to have that mental picture for parents in their minds, that they can hopefully hold on to rather than feel divisive, divided. They are interconnected. It's so invaluable.
And I think also that it's not just separated parents or divorced parents. It's just parents generally, because, I mean, if how many of us know situations, or maybe we are in situations growing up where, you know, there's a family where it's common knowledge that the parents hate each other, but they stayed together, you know, because that was just what was done, or it's socially acceptable, or even financially, it was just too hard.
Yeah.
So, you know, and if you look at those children who are now adults, you can see in many cases sort of this unresolved impact of their parents' conflict.
Oh, definitely. You know, it's a lifelong thing we all work with, I think, is the influence our parents have had on us and the multi-generational effect of...
That's right. That's right. It's not just that. And I mean, Australia is a country of, I guess, you know, we have First Nations who, you know, were really and still to an extent mistreated.
Yes.
So they've got that intergenerational trauma. And then we've got the migrants who came to Australia for a specific reason.
Yes.
And generally it wasn't a good reason that they left.
Yes.
Or they had to leave. So there's also a lot of that, you know, many, many people came here after war or during war. So there's also that added layer of complexity.
Yes, plus, as you just said, the rise of the sensitive child. So this trauma-informed approach, what led you towards that?
Well, I guess once I started working as a family mediator, it really only made sense that I study couples counselling and family therapy to really help my practice and also add more meaning. I thought it would help. And what happened was I was constantly surrounded by psychologists and counsellors and other mental health practitioners, and sort of became exploring trauma-informed approaches in neuroscience. And most of my professional development was in areas of mental health.
Yes.
So then I started to see an overlay between what I was seeing in mediation rooms and what I was studying and reading about in terms of child development and trauma.
And the mediation process itself and the family breakdown or having to mediate, that would have a cause for producing trauma in the child because of the trauma the parents go through, I presume, as well.
Yes. And I find that historically, approaches to separation are not trauma-informed.
Yes.
So this is also about breaking through from old ways of seeing situations and handling situations, because people going through separation and divorce now, for most of them or many of them, it's their first time going through that process. And their experience of separation and divorce can be quite varied.
Yes.
Impacted by so many, you know, cultural and factors. There's too many variables. So it's also about rewriting our society's approach to separation and divorce and how it's been managed. Because if you're a child who's maybe in your 40s going through separation now, and your parents went through separation 30 years ago, it's a very different system. And even, you know, look at, you had to go to family court if you wanted an outcome. The child support agency was only set up, I think it was in the 80s. So before then, there was, you know, you could pay child support, but there was no mechanism to organise it. And if you are in a situation where you can't see your child, and in order to do that, you have to pay thousands of dollars to go to court, then you're being asked to pay money to support the child, then it, I believe it's why there's a trend of adults now in their sort of mid to late 30s, 40s, 50s, whose parents separated in the 70s and 80s, who have little or no relationship with their father.
Oh, and even today, I have friends and colleagues who have recently gone through this archaic process. And it is so divisive and destructive for those relationships, particularly with father and child, adult, or yeah. emerging adult child. I completely agree. I think this new approach, this so-called alternate approach, sounds so much more healing.
And society has changed since then. You know, if we look at the past, the father, you know, was normally the provider, yeah. and then we had stay-at-home mums.
Yeah.
You aren't, that's a luxury now, yeah. I believe, you
yes.
know.
Yes.
So now most parents work.
Yes.
And so that's also changed the dynamics and the care of the children as well.
Yep.
So on one hand, there's more reliance on both parents being able to work together, but that also requires an understanding or respect.
And your alternate approach also, I think, is empowering for the more traditional structures of men, where we often found men felt so disempowered that they would even become less employed in order to pay less child support. But that really backfired, as you say, on the relationship between them and the children.
Yeah, and that's quite a big conflicting interest throughout the process, because there's this financial and relationship, because if I don't have the money, then how can I give my child everything that I want to give them? So then I have to work, therefore I'm spending less time with them. And it just cycles like that. And I mean, I don't know what the solution is, because I mean, life is getting more and more expensive.
Yes.
So we need that. I guess it's a trade-off between balancing that financial element and relationship. And I think you're right, in the past, the financial element took priority because of how the system was run.
Yeah, whereas this way of looking at it, where both adult parents tend to have to work, can end up being a mutually empowered result for each of them, because their time spent working and spent with the kids can be more equal and therefore more healthy and functional.
Yeah. I guess it depends. Each situation can be different, and that would be the ideal, to have equal. And the legislation talks about shared parental responsibility, which is going through some changes and what that means. But essentially it's about the responsibility being on the parents to care for the children the best way that they can, to have a meaningful relationship. But so that the children have a meaningful relationship with both parents. And that's also, you know, quoting the legislation. So it's about the quality of the relationship rather than the quantity. I mean, you know, younger children need more demanding and, you know, hands-on sort of care.
Yeah.
So that can be a challenge in sort of, you know, how can it be balanced, equal, and in the best interests of child development, what the child needs. So it's there's no one answer, but what's going to work best is what works best for that family and what both parents agree to, because you've already removed the conflict. And so the research might say, this is the way you should raise your child and this is what they should be doing, but doing it that way causes conflict.
Yes.
So that's where I think, well, maybe, I mean, assuming there's no harm, abuse or safety issues, if it works for that family, who am I to say, I don't think you should do it that way, or the research says, you know? And my role technically is not to judge.
Yeah.
If something works for that family, particularly if you have a sensitive child or a highly anxious child, then different ballgame.
Yeah. And I just imagine you could be in a position like a general counsellor or a general practitioner, where families could check in again when they're not able to resolve a dynamic change within the family structure, as you say, from younger children to, say, teen children who want a change of how much time is spent with either parent or the way the family is operating as a sort of separated family, that it can be a more organic, evolving, changing, growing situation where they could have someone like you to just regroup with.
Yeah, that's right. And often families do come back because there are, you know, milestones, changing milestones or events or any sort of change, you know, the children growing up and having different needs or able to do a little bit more or less, whatever the case may be. So that's often can instigate a return to mediation, or some parents will often put in a review, let's come back in 12 months or 6 months or whatever the case may be. And if, you know, sometimes it gets cancelled because things are going smooth and there haven't been major changes, sometimes they come back earlier. So it's really organic. It's dependent on the family. And, you know, I guess some of them, you know, going through that initial hurdle of separation and learning how to reestablish their relationship, because that's really the biggest change how that they work and relate with each other.
Yeah.
So once they're through that, they don't necessarily have to come back to mediation.
Mm.
So, you know, some many don't.
Wow.
How service is there, because I mean, I believe it's you know, a great service where there's someone there to facilitate the conversation.
Yeah.
And they're not going to take sides. They're not going to be like your friends or family who will say, oh my gosh, I can't believe this happened again. You need to do this. No, it's not, it's more about the children and coming together. And then if you want a written agreement out of that, you also have that.
So is that the parenting plan agreement as well?
So, yeah, well, a parenting plan is an agreement that both parents have reached that's been typed up or written in any way and signed and dated by both parents. So yep. If it's not signed and dated, it's a parenting agreement.
Yep.
But signed and dated, it can be used if it did go to court, it can be relied on as evidence. Or it could then be taken to a solicitor to be made into court orders if both parents consent to. So it's just a matter of signing and dating that puts more sort of status, legal status on the document, but you don't have to. It's really up to each family.
This sounds like it's a lot less adversarial.
Yes.
Than going to court. And that would be a preference, I would have thought, for normal families and normal people to not want that conflict and to be able to settle this amicably or at least harmoniously and without the angst of court and the expense, because that would be much more expensive than doing it with you, wouldn't it?
Yes, that's right. And I mean, families can't access the court immediately unless there are safety and urgent issues, unless they've seen a mediator. So that's also filtered families away from the court.
Yes, of course.
Well, the families that could try mediation first. There are some families that obviously need to be in a process where they're supported by, you know, legal practitioners and other staff and can show evidence. But for those that aren't necessarily in that situation, then they can go to mediation.
And I love your earlier point that really this is about re-engineering the relationship between the couple because of the breakdown. It's a complete change of the relationship that they formed and under which they produced the child, that once you've corrected, I guess, the rearrangement of the relationship to being a healthy one for the new family, if you like, or the new structure of the family, everything's much easier for them.
Yes, yes. And I guess for many, you know, when you're in a relationship, you rely on each other.
Yes.
So that can be a big element and a cause of complaint.
Yes.
He or she, they're relying on me too much. We're not in a relationship anymore. And that can take time to undo.
Yeah, absolutely. And then.
And sometimes it can still work. So that's the balance. It's how it really depends on the quality of the parents' relationship to be able to do that. And provided there are no sort of, you know, safety concerns, if you have a child with high needs, you have to rely on the other parent.
Absolutely. And regarding the individuals, do you do any counselling of those individual adult parents as well, or do you leave that to other people? Because a lot of those individuals, in order to do all of this, would need the support and the healing themselves from, as you said, the intergenerational, multi-generational trauma that gets passed down and may play out in these situations.
Yes, and I would often make referrals or say, look, I think if, you know, both parents did some individual counselling and then came back to mediation, it might be useful, or at the same time, or I might slow down the process as well.
Yeah.
So, but often referrals. And look, sometimes once clients have come to me, particularly when I'm working in the government-funded family relationship centres, there are counsellors there. So often they've already been linked in with counsellors. But I guess if they haven't, or even in their own community, but yeah, it would be something that I would look at referring or suggesting.
Wonderful. And Rosemary, you have a new book. How exciting. Please tell me and tell us about your new book.
Yeah, it's really about my observations as a mediator of how I guess what I saw, the trends that I noticed in the way people manage adversity.
Yes.
And that then really highlighted to me this concept of almost being able to predict whether or not someone will overcome and triumph through their challenges, or whether or not that process might be slower for them, or they might be overcome by their challenges.
Yeah. Wow. So therein is such an important tool for people going through this kind of separation process, co-parenting and so forth. And the title of your book, It's Not You, It's Me.
Yes.
Fantastic. Endorsed by Patria King and Professor Stephen Porges.
Yes, I'm so honoured to get those endorsements. It's pretty amazing.
It's so amazing. Congratulations.
They're sort of, you know, leaders in the treatment of trauma.
Yeah, absolutely. And so there must be a lot of help about trauma in your book.
Yeah, so I guess what I propose a strengths-based tool for self-reflection, and it's really a way of categorizing our thoughts, feelings, and actions in that moment, or reflecting on past situations to help build resilience and personal growth. And essentially what I propose is that all thoughts, feelings, and actions can be categorized under coming under what's wrong or what's strong.
Wow, I love it.
And so the what's wrong from the brain's perspective can signal to the brain I'm unsafe.
Yes.
And the what's strong is safe. So for the brain perspective, there's two options, I'm safe or unsafe.
Yes.
So that's kind of the neurobiology of this proposal and how it sort of links in with trauma-informed. When we're trauma-informed, we're more towards what's strong in a situation and in ourselves, which puts our brain closer to safe.
Yes.
Whereas what's wrong is going towards not being trauma-informed and telling our brain we're unsafe, and then we would respond accordingly. And so it's about being trauma-informed with ourselves and trauma-informed with others as a way to reflect.
Oh, how wonderful. How much resilience this must provide people. And your workshops are based on your book, I presume?
Yes. Yes, it's all based on the book. So I've been running workshops with mental health practitioners and mediators on working in a trauma-informed way, and it's really about showing practical ways, what we do that comes under what's strong. And for many of us, we do that anyway.
Mm.
It's just, I guess, naming it in a very user-friendly way, and also, I guess, to use in our own professional supervision. How can we approach our own work from a what's strong perspective?
Yeah, and I imagine that in your workshops, people actually can train themselves to be much more conscious of what's wrong, and when they're in that wrong way of thinking, or thinking that things are wrong rather than strong. So they would develop and grow enormously, I'm sure.
It's quite easy to make that differentiation. And I'm also now running the workshops in high schools.
Oh, excellent.
And someone read my book and she said she had a very anxious teenage daughter and that the concepts in my book helped her. And so that's kind of planted the seed for the workshop. So that's also coming up.
That's fantastic. So, Rosemary, I ask all my guests, what makes you psyched for life?
Well, actually, there's a lot of things that do, like conversations like this.
Yeah.
Connecting with people that I've met sort of randomly on LinkedIn as well, and then, you know, finding out these great connections. That's definitely one thing. But I guess personally, I really do enjoy music. My grandfather was a musician. my uncles were all, you know, musicians, and my brothers as well. They can all a lot of the men in my family can play by ear. I have to study, but that's okay. I can go to concerts as well.
Yeah.
So I love anytime I can go to the opera house. I'm in Sydney, so anytime I can go to the opera house, I'll be there.
Oh, beautiful. And to find Rosemary, people can go to?
Yes, rosemarygattuso.com.
And they can find all kinds of things there at your website.
Yes, so there's where to get my book from and workshop details, how to contact me and all my social media, everything's on the website.
And so to that sensitive child that is arising, your workshops and your book can help with that as well.
Yes, and I when I run workshops in high schools, I also offer an information night for the parents and a workshop also for the teachers. So everyone's sort of on board, and each session is different and catered towards, you know, the parents and teachers' perspective and involvement, and also so that they know what their children have learned.
Oh, this is so important for our time, Rosemary. What a gift.
No, thank you.
Wow, great resources. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Rosemary. It's been a delight talking with you.
Thank you. It's been great. Take care.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. Plus, don't forget you can access all of the resources mentioned in today's podcast via the show notes. Is there a pressing issue or topic you'd like me to discuss? Head to my Instagram at @dramandaferguson and send me a DM. I love hearing from my listeners. If anything discussed in this podcast has caused you concern or distress, contact your general practitioner or health provider. To locate a psychologist in your area, call the Australian Psychological Society and locate Find a Psychologist service on 1800 333 497, or visit www.findapsychologist.org.au. If you or someone you know is in crisis, Lifeline is available 24/7 on 13 11 14, and Kids Helpline, again 24/7 on 1800 55 1800, and both are free of charge. To find out more about me, please visit my website, dramandaferguson.com.au. You can find the link in my show notes. The opinions expressed by guests in these podcasts aren't necessarily shared by me.